This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Oh my God! Breaking up!
It's been called the Arctic Death Spiral. All-time lows for polar sea ice have been shattered this year. Sooner or later, there will be no sea ice in the Arctic in the summer months. Professor Peter Wadhams of Cambridge University, previously a guest on Radio EcoShock, now predicts we could see the open Arctic Ocean as soon as 2015. All the 24-hour power of the summer sun will pour into the polar ocean, instead of being reflected back into space. A new article in the journal Nature reports parts of Arctic Siberia are already releasing far more carbon dioxide and methane than previously thought. The National Snow and Ice Data Center says lack of sea ice could drive heat up to 900 miles further inland, threatening to melt the permafrost. Most scientists agree that would trigger runaway global warming well beyond anything we can do to stop it. It's an Arctic emergency, plain and simple, a warning sign Earth's climate is tipping into a new hothouse age. We need all the facts we can get, and I've lined up three of the best scientists for this week's show. We'll talk with atmospheric scientist and polar expert Dr. Cecilia Bitz from the University of Washington. We'll get the latest figures and tips for tracking the polar ice yourself from the director of the National Sea and Ice Data Center, Dr. Mark Cerise. But first, I want you to hear from the Rutgers University scientist who is stirring up meteorologists, TV weather people, and government insiders. Dr. Jennifer Francis says the meltback of Arctic sea ice is already affecting the climate of the whole Northern Hemisphere. Forget the sound bites and the secondhand guessing. Radio EcoShock is your door inside the cutting edge of climate science. Jennifer Francis is a research professor at the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences at Rutgers University in New Jersey. She's an atmospheric scientist who specializes in the Arctic. Dr. Francis has published many papers, and don't miss her important presentation on YouTube from the Weather and Climate Summit held at Breckenridge, Colorado in January 2012. The New York Times has also interviewed her about a new theory: melting Arctic sea ice could change our weather further south. Dr. Francis, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Well, a new record Arctic sea ice melt is occurring already in August 2012, with more to come in September. To me, this may be the single largest impact of human activity on the planet. It's hard to exaggerate how big this story is, don't you think?
You know, I do think it's hard to exaggerate because it is such a remarkable event to have reached a record minimum in the ice extent at this early date in the season. Normally, we don't reach the minimum until the middle of September. So, as you mentioned, we still have a couple of weeks left of the melt season, and so we expect there to be quite a bit more melting going on, which means that the old record is going to be positively shattered. And it is also remarkable because it's such a visual event. People can look at a satellite image and really get a sense for just how huge this change to the climate system really is.
Right. It looks like the last of the Arctic ice is kind of hovering around that large chain of islands in the Canadian Arctic, and the entire west side of the Arctic Ocean looks open. The fabled Northwest Passage is open. The sea ice has melted away from the entire Russian coast. Would you change or add to that description?
No, I think you're absolutely right, and that's what's so obvious in the satellite imagery. And the only reason it's left in that area north of Canada all along that coast there is because that's where the thickest ice has existed as far back as we can see, and it will just take a little longer for it to melt there, but ultimately it probably will melt there too in the summer and not the too distant future.
And it looks like a small space when we look at it from space, but if you're on a ship in the Arctic, it must be a vast area we're talking about.
It is, and the ice that exists that's left in the Arctic is much thinner than it used to be. It's much more broken up. It was described yesterday by one of my colleagues as being slushy, like a big slushy, and I think that's a very good way to describe what we have left up there. So because it's so thin and because it's broken means that it's now much more vulnerable to any abnormalities in either the winds or the ocean currents that might come along that, if it had happened 30 years ago, would have had no impact whatsoever.
Back in 2005, you joined a group of scientists in a paper predicting the Arctic would be ice-free eventually in summer. And when that massive ice melt in 2007 struck, we wondered maybe that's a freak event. What are scientists predicting now?
I think just about everyone who is truly involved in any kind of Arctic climate work or Arctic meteorological work believes that it won't be very long before we see a summer Arctic with little or no ice at all in it anymore. And, you know, the dates range from anything from one decade from now to 5 decades from now, but certainly within most of our lifetimes. And that's going to be a remarkable event.
Jennifer Francis, let's go with your presentation at the Weather and Climate Summit last January. You gave us a theory of how this record summer sea ice melt could already be changing our climate. So can you explain that for us? And please take as long as you want.
Sure. So actually, I wouldn't call it a theory so much as observations that support the idea that the Arctic warming and the enhanced Arctic warming is affecting the circulation in the atmosphere. And what we see is that the Arctic is warming about twice as fast as the rest of the hemisphere or the rest of the globe. It's warming faster than anywhere else on the planet, except possibly for the peninsula of the Antarctic. And that's just a very small region. Now, we have to understand what drives weather systems in the northern hemisphere, and that is this phenomenon we call the jet stream. The jet stream you can think of as a river of fast-moving air that's high above our heads, and it pretty much encircles the hemisphere, and it typically has waves in it, very similar to a river, but these waves go north and south as the jet stream encircles the northern hemisphere. What drives this jet stream is the difference in temperature between the warm tropics and the mid-latitudes and the colder Arctic. The larger this temperature difference is, the stronger the jet stream is. So in the old days, or when the ice was thick up there and the Arctic was much colder than it has been lately, this difference in temperature has been large, and so the jet stream has been stronger in the west to east part of its winds. As we warm the Arctic faster than the rest of the northern hemisphere, that means this difference in temperature is getting smaller. And what we see as a result of that is that the jet stream winds in the west to east direction are getting weaker, just as we would expect to see knowing that the Arctic's getting warmer faster. And not only that, but these waves in the jet stream that I mentioned, if you warm the northern tips of these waves more than you do the rest of the wave, it tends to stretch those peaks in the waves farther northward. And what this does is it makes those waves larger in the north-south direction. So you can picture looking down from a satellite at the, say, the United States, and you would see the waves actually extending farther northward in as they go through their swings north and south around the planet. Now, what this means is that both of these factors together, the weakened jet stream and also the larger waves, both have the same end result, and that is to make these waves in the jet stream move more slowly from west to east. Now, why does that matter? Well, any meteorologist will tell you that when the waves in the jet stream are larger, which happens naturally, we see sometimes they're large and sometimes they're small, but when they're large, we know that the weather systems associated with those waves also move more slowly. So what does that mean? That means that the weather conditions that are occurring at any given point around the northern hemisphere associated with these waves are going to last longer. It's going to feel like your weather is stuck in a particular set of conditions. So if you happen to be in a dry part of the weather pattern, then that dryness is going to continue longer. If you're in a rainy pattern, it'll stay rainy longer. And we can think of some examples of that over the last couple of years in particular, where a couple winters ago, not this past winter, but the two winters before that, we had very cold, snowy winters in the East Coast of the United States that just seemed to go on forever. And the winter after that, we had just the opposite. We had a very mild, dry winter. And both of those were associated with weather patterns that just were very slow to change. We've seen the same kinds of things happening in Europe, in Alaska. You know, the same concept is that whatever weather you've got just tends to stick around longer. And this, we believe, is at least partly tied to the warming in the Arctic being stronger or larger warming than it is in the rest of the hemisphere, causing these waves to move more slowly.
And how much is this being accepted by other scientists? Is there criticism? Is there support?
Well, in our paper, we showed actual observations that this was indeed occurring. When you have observations, it wasn't just a model predicting this was going to happen in the future. So when you show observations of an event like this or a behavior, people tend to be more accepting. And I think, you know, on the whole, I'd say most scientists I know are at least receptive to the idea. And as we go forward, I know there's a lot of people that have jumped on this idea and they're looking into it further, and as am I. And so I think we'll find further evidence that this is indeed occurring. Other research is using models to look forward in time and see whether this sort of behavior will continue or maybe even become even more enhanced as we continue to add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere and as we continue to see sea ice disappear in the Arctic.
Well, I think listeners in the UK, where the weather was just so wet and it seemed like it would never end, or maybe even in Eastern Europe a couple of years ago when it was so cold and it seemed like it would never go away, or the drought this year in the American Midwest, this starts to make sense in terms of the Arctic sea ice melt could be part of that.
I should mention that in the summertime, the extreme weather that we get in the summer is actually probably not directly linked to the sea ice. I think it's actually directly linked more to the rapid decrease in the amount of snow cover on high-latitude land. Over the last couple of decades, while the sea ice has been melting, we've also been observing that the snow has been melting ever earlier from high-latitude land areas. And this has a very similar effect as the sea ice does, but in a different season, of course. And what happens is when you remove the snow earlier, you expose the soil to the strong spring sunshine earlier, which allows that soil to warm up earlier. And so you end up with the same situation that I described for the sea ice, where you're enhancing the temperatures at high latitudes in the Arctic more than lower latitudes. So the same thing's happening. You're reducing this temperature difference, which also weakens the jet stream and I think is playing a role in the drought that we had this year in the U.S., heat waves, and other summer types of extreme weather.
And we've also heard warnings that retreating ice means a change in the salt content of the sea, which could produce more climate changes, perhaps if the Gulf Stream warming New England or Northern Europe weakens. Have you looked into that? Is it a serious possibility? And if so, how might that develop?
I have not looked into that myself particularly, but I do know that the changes in the ocean circulation have a much longer time period associated with them. It takes a long time for an ocean current like the Gulf Stream to change. And while we may be adding fresh water to the Arctic Ocean, a lot of that fresh water that has been added because of ice melting and actually also from increased river runoff from rivers that flow into the Arctic Ocean, most of that fresh water actually ends up hugging the coast as it exits the Arctic Ocean because of the circulation patterns in the ocean currents. And so it ends up not affecting a very large area. So my feeling is that if there's an impact, it's going to take a long time for it to show up, and it will probably be a relatively small area that's affected.
This is Radio EcoShock with Rutgers atmospheric scientist, Dr. Jennifer Francis. Dr. Francis, shipping has already started through the Arctic Ocean. Oil companies want to drill it. Fishing fleets expect a new harvest. Is it possible the economic benefits of the open Arctic might outweigh the climate changes that we've discussed?
I personally believe that they will not. The extreme weather that I've just been talking about affects millions upon millions, in fact, billions of people, because we're talking about the population that lives in the Northern Hemisphere, which is, you know, a large fraction of the Earth's population, whereas the benefits of shipping and oil exploration up in the Arctic, while it will add to our energy independence, which is a good thing, I don't see that the economic benefits are going to trickle down to affect enough people to offset the detrimental effects of of large-scale climate change.
Well, this critical link between what is happening in the Arctic and really the climate of the world could wake up the public. And I'm wondering if there's a way that we can further bolster these observations. What science still needs to be done?
Well, there's a lot of science yet to be done. We have these wonderful tools that we call we generally refer to as the models or the climate models. They do a remarkable job of simulating how the climate system works, but they're not perfect, and especially given the fact that we're entering new territory, if you will. The climate system is doing things that we've never seen before, things like new record minimum ice extents, for example. And so some of the mathematics in these models that simulate the climate system, which were developed for a world that we knew over the last few decades, may not be exactly right for the world that we're heading into. So there's a lot of research still to be done to perfect the models, and I believe they're doing a remarkable job, but there are things that could be better, and some of those details will be very important going forward in understanding how the changes in the climate system are going to be felt in different parts of the world. And I feel that's very important because what we really need to focus on now is how people are going to be affected, how we can help mitigate some of those effects so that, you know, less damage is done and people don't suffer any more than they already will. So there's plenty to be done, and we're always looking for smart young minds to bring us new ideas, and there's plenty of room for people to get involved in that research.
Well, frankly, on a personal level, the news about this year's record melt of the summer sea ice leaves me with a sense of worry, if not horror. What are Arctic specialists like yourself feeling about this?
Well, I have to admit that I share that feeling. As the indicators that we're seeing, not just, you know, the Arctic sea ice, but in the snow melt that I mentioned, it's a very robust signal. The increases in extreme weather, the heavy rains that have been recorded that have, you know, never been recorded before in some places, all of these things are falling into line with what the models and what scientists have been saying are likely to happen as we continue to increase the amount of heat-trapping greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. It gives me a sense of deep concern. I mean, I have two children, and I worry about the world that they're inheriting. I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of this kind of extreme weather, and I think it's going to be a tough problem to turn around. I personally don't think that we're going to be able to decrease the emissions of greenhouse gases enough in this foreseeable future to make a big difference. And so I think we're going to have to focus, as I mentioned earlier, on more on understanding where the impacts are going to be felt so that we can help those people and those habitats and the agricultural systems and everything that's going to be affected to minimize those impacts. So it's a very serious situation, and it boggles my mind that people aren't seeing some of these changes before their very eyes and not believing that human activities aren't playing a role there.
Right. To be able to deny something like the whole poles are melting, you have to really blind yourself to be able to do that. And it's interesting, you talked to the Weather and Climate Summit, and just this August, the American Meteorological Society came out with a much stronger statement that they acknowledge climate science and that the world is warming and so on. Were you aware of that?
Yes, I, in fact, just read it this morning, as a matter of fact. Yes, it's a lot stronger than the previous one, and I think it's very well-timed, and I'm 100% behind the statement.
Well, maybe that's some good news. We could certainly use more TV weather people telling us why these changes are happening. You've been listening to Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University on Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Find links to her site and her fascinating YouTube lecture at the 2012 Weather and Climate Summit in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you, Dr. Francis, for this valuable time together.
You are very welcome, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have at any time.
This is the Radio EcoShock special on the crash of the Arctic sea ice 2012. Coming up next, Mark Cerise and Cecilia Bitts.
Radio EcoShock.
When it comes to the Arctic, one of the first stops for both media and scientists is the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. Radio EcoShock is pleased to have as our guest NSIDC Director and Senior Research Scientist, Dr. Mark Cerise. Mark, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on.
Well, to start off, what is the National Snow and Ice Data Center? Is it a government agency?
National Snow and Ice Data Center is not a government agency. We're actually part of the University of Colorado in Boulder, and we are really a research center. We do a number of different things. We do a lot of research on the changing cryosphere, that's the Earth's snow and ice cover, but we also do a lot of data management. That is, we handle a lot of the satellite data from which we assess what's happening to the Arctic sea ice cover, to ice sheets, etc. So we're not a government research center, but like most university centers, yes, we obtain most of our funding from sources like the National Science Foundation or NASA.
And when I picture your work, I think of some really big computers chewing through the best satellite measuring system in the world. Is that realistic?
That is very realistic. If you go upstairs in our building, there'll be a room filled with servers and disks and blinking lights and a lot of whirring. Yeah, we have a very big computer and data storage systems here, and we certainly do crunch a lot of numbers.
And a new record low amount of Arctic sea ice for the summer 2012 season has already been announced up to September 5th. Can you tell us where it stands?
Well, yeah, we broke the old record back, I think it was in August 26th. The old record was held in 2007, not that long ago, of something like, I think it was 4.17 million square kilometers, if that means anything. But we broke that record, and the melt season is still not over. That's what's remarkable. So right now, we were down to something like 3.6 million square kilometers. The old record was about 4.7. So we've pretty much blown that old record away. And we haven't reached bottom yet. So it's been a remarkable year.
And how much smaller is that compared to what we might have seen around 1980?
Yeah, well, if you compare it to data we have from, say, the 1970s to 1980s, that how much ice we have now, say, in late August and September, we've probably lost about 40% of it. So the Arctic sea ice cover is in deep trouble, and I don't see things getting any better.
Are scientists making any predictions about this final record, what it will be for 2012?
Well, we never quite know because a lot of it depends on what the weather patterns are over the next few weeks. And, of course, you can't predict weather very well. I would guess we'd be something like 3.6 million, something like that. And that's a pretty low number, but we'll just have to wait and see. But, you know, we're just kind of rather worried about this.
Well, Dr. Mark Cerise, why is the Arctic showing such big changes decades earlier than scientists predicted even 10 years ago?
Well, one thing we have to remember is that for many, many years, it had been realized that when the Earth starts to warm up, we'd see the changes first in the Arctic, and that's where they'd be most pronounced. In fact, it was even back in the late 1800s that a fellow named Svante Arrhenius actually predicted this. So this is nothing new. We always knew it was the Arctic where we were going to see the changes first, and that's because of these climate feedbacks that some of you may have heard about, things like we start to lose the snow and ice cover, exposes darker underlying surfaces that absorbs more of the sun's energy, causes more melt, and so on. But despite that, we really have been surprised at the rapidity of some of these changes. And this is a case where the research is actually having a hard time keeping up with the pace of change.
Have scientists estimated how much of the sea ice meltdown could be due to natural cycles and how much is due to human-induced greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, it's not easy to make a distinct split between those, and it's not necessarily very productive either because the two feed off each other. An example of that is that we know that because of overall warming of the Arctic through many years, the ice is now thinner than it used to be. Well, what that means now is a storm that comes through and disrupts the ice cover, which could cause a further loss of ice, is more effective in doing so now. So we've kind of changed the game here. It's a bit difficult to separate the two. But there is no doubt at all that the Arctic is now responding to increased levels of greenhouse gases. That seems to be incontrovertible at this point, and we'll see how long we can retain that summer ice cover. It may be only a few decades now. You go out this time of year, look at the Arctic from space, and it's essentially a blue ocean.
Mark Cerise, when the sea ice refreezes this year in the polar region, will it be thinner? Will it be more prone to further records in years to come?
Yeah, that's really the way we're looking at it, is that what we're doing now is that we're already setting ourselves up for another low year next year, because what's going to happen is with all this open water we have in the Arctic Ocean right now, well, of course, that's going to refreeze through autumn and winter. But come spring, this is going to be fairly thin ice. And it's that fairly thin ice, which is the stuff that more readily melts out the next summer. So every year we sort of get to this point where we lose more and more ice. It kind of sets us up for more of the same next year. So it's a bit of a vicious cycle.
I talked to some climate scientists, and the capability they ask for most is better ways to measure that ice thickness. Is the United States working on improved ice monitoring?
Yes, the United States is very, I think, invested on coming up with better ways to monitor the ice cover. What we can do from satellites easily is measure the extent of ice. That is, how many square kilometers or how many square miles of ice there is. What's a much harder thing to do is measure the thickness of the ice. But the reality is the best measure of the overall health of the ice cover is how thick it is. Well, we have some ways to do this. We had a satellite up there called ICESat, which was actually giving us information on ice thickness. It actually carried a laser altimeter system. Well, ICESat died a little while ago, and a new satellite called ICESat 2 goes up in 2016. Right now, there's something called Operation Ice Bridge, and what it is a series of aircraft overflights carrying all kinds of instruments. And one of the things we'll do is make flights over the ice cover from which we can get information on thickness. So our resources for looking at the thickness are okay. They're not as good as just measuring the extent. But I think when we get ICESat 2 in orbit, we're really going to have those good capabilities. So it's something that we're working hard on.
What do you think of the observation made by scientists like Jennifer Francis of Rutgers that a reduction in Arctic sea ice could be changing the jet stream and affecting weather further south in both Eurasia and North America?
Yeah, there's very good evidence that that sort of thing is happening. I've worked with actually Dr. Francis for a number of years. So one of the things we've worked on together is this issue of Arctic amplification. This is the outsized rise in air temperatures over the Arctic compared to lower latitudes, and that in large part is driven by the loss of sea ice cover. Well, there's a lot of evidence both from climate models and now from observations that as we warm that Arctic strongly, as we lose the ice cover, this is going to have impacts on patterns of weather and precipitation, not just in the Arctic, but beyond the Arctic. The way to think of this is that if we warm the Arctic strongly compared to the middle latitudes, what this does is it changes the nature of the jet stream. And, of course, it's the jet stream that really controls so much of the weather we have. So that's where it all sort of links together. Now, is there sort of a smoking gun yet? Can we really say for sure that the observed loss of Arctic sea ice is already having impacts on weather, say, in middle latitudes? Jennifer would probably say yes, or she would definitely say yes. I would say I'd like to see a few more years of data come in, but I think we're definitely heading in the direction of her research.
When Radio EcoShock returns, more about the Arctic death spiral from Dr. Mark Cerise, Director and Senior Research Scientist from the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center.